Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Audible is the home of storytelling, and it lets you enjoy all of your audio entertainment in one app. You'll always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. In fact, I've been really into thrillers and true crime lately, and I just got back from a long car trip where I was listening to the latest zombie Fallout book, Bridging the Gap. And I swear, I had to keep checking the back seat for any glowing eyes as I drove home on that deserted highway. In fact, on so many of my journeys, Audible is there for me, with comedy, bestsellers, history, exclusive originals, and more. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. That's audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. We've all been there. Maybe we used one or two misleading words in a shared document, and then the whole team spends a lot of wasted time trying to get on the same page. But we don't need to make those mistakes. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all of the wasted time and money that goes with it. I spend a lot of time writing. I write scripts, emails, speeches, proposals, you name it. And Grammarly helps me find the right tone. It does so much more than correct grammar. It's almost like a trusted writing partner. And when every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Teams that communicate better with Grammarly report 52% less time spent writing sales emails and 66% less time spent editing marketing content. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. This show is brought to you by Schwab. You're here because you like to keep a pulse on trends in technology. Well, now you can invest in what's trending in artificial intelligence, big data, robotic revolution, and more with Schwab Investing Themes. It's an easy way to invest in ideas you believe in. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends, then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes, buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to benefit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing. Hey, it's Guy here, and today we've got another episode from the How I Built This Summit that we held in San Francisco this past October. And this week, we're featuring Katrina Lake, founder of Stitch Fix, a personal shopping service for women and men. My original interview with Katrina ran earlier this year, and if you haven't heard it, you might want to give it a listen, because Katrina's story is pretty amazing. She's built a billion-dollar business and is the youngest female CEO ever to take a company public. But she's also one of those founders who didn't really set out to be a founder. Katrina and I sat down together in front of a live audience at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. All right. So let's just start with your self-perception as, you know, as an entrepreneur. You didn't, you know, one of the interesting things that we talked about briefly on the podcast, but we didn't go into too much detail on it, was you didn't think of yourself as somebody who was going to start a company and run a big organization and be a leader of all these people. Like, that wasn't how you saw yourself, and that wasn't your intention. I mean, obviously you're doing it, but why? Why was that?
Yeah, it's funny. I look back, and it is one of the things that I'm, you know, passionate about, of how can we make entrepreneurship something that feels more accessible and more real to more people. Because I think I look back, and in my childhood, like, nobody thought I would be an entrepreneur and encouraged me to be an entrepreneur. Like, my mom is she just retired actually, but she was a public school teacher. My dad is a doctor in the public university system. I don't know that I was raised with that as even a possibility in my mind. And it's funny, because sometimes people ask me, like, oh, you went to Stanford, did that did that make you realize you wanted to be an entrepreneur? And in some strange ways, it actually had the opposite effect of, like, the people who were the entrepreneur types at Stanford were very different than kind of how I saw myself. And so it took a really long time, I think, for me to realize that entrepreneurship would be a good path for me. And I think there's a lot of other people out there that would be pretty good at it that maybe haven't had that exposure or haven't had that push. And so, you know, it's definitely one of the things that I'm passionate about, you know, making sure that this path is available to more people.
What did you think an entrepreneur was supposed to be? Like, what did you think it meant, or what was that person like in your mind?
I mean, it's just, it really is, you know, who you have exposure to. It's like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was around the Stanford campus when I was in school. Google was created around the time that I was in school. There's, you know, kind of largely this, like, coder, code in your garage, like, wear Adidas flip-flops kind of, like, right. kind of personality that, yeah. That, you know, didn't feel all that accessible to me.
Yeah. As you mentioned in the podcast, in the early days, you had to raise a lot of money because you needed a lot of money to get this thing off the ground. You had to buy inventory and you had to build all the technology around it. And you described Stitch Fix really as a tech company. You told me that male VCs, and that they were mostly men that you were meeting with, were not passionate about dressing women. How did you convince them, or at least some of them, otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, we actually didn't raise that much money. We raised less than $50 million. The business is now over $1 billion. And so, you know, I think the amount of capital that we raised was actually very modest relative to, you know, where we'd end up. But in the early days, yes, we did need money. And so we raised, I think, $500,000 in a seed round, and then we raised a couple million in an A round. But, you know, we weren't raising these huge, you know, crazy size venture rounds. And, you know, candidly, like, I wasn't able to. Like, a fundraising was not the thing that I'm best in the world at.
You hated doing that.
I hated it because I was bad at it. I mean, we raised, you know, on some extent, you can say that building a $1 billion business on less than $50 million, that's something to be proud of. Like, it's honestly the result that, like, fundraising is not my towering strength. It's not the thing that helped me to be a good entrepreneur. You know, I probably wasn't very good at it then. I don't know that I'm terribly good at it now. You know, capital wasn't necessarily one of those things that helped us to be successful.
You know, we showed some survey results from a survey that we commissioned just earlier today, and it showed that women entrepreneurs who responded, some of them in this audience, you know, they've reported bias against them as they try to grow their business. And I want to ask you about this for a moment, because of what you represent, the youngest female founder to take a company public, and you created this $1 billion company. Do you like being seen that way? Is it irritating to you when people kind of say, oh, here's this great woman founder? Do you embrace it? How do you feel about it?
I mean, I think I'm, you know, mostly positive, but it's sometimes mixed. Like, you know, I think there are times when, you know, it can be like, oh, she's a great female CEO. I'm like, I just want to be a great CEO. Like, I don't need the female part of it. I just want to be a great CEO.
Yeah.
And so that part can irritate me because, you know, I think at this point, like, we have the credentials to back that up. The flip side, I feel immensely proud and really responsible to be able to show people like me this path. And so I, you know, I'm very proud that I am a woman. I'm very proud that I don't look like all of the other, you know, public company CEOs out there. And those are things that I think, you know, I feel like just by being on this stage, I can have an impact. And I think is really, really important.
Yeah. Do you feel like things are starting to change or turn a corner, or do you think it's more of the same?
I mean, I think there just has to be positive change. Like, you know, I don't know that we're turning a corner, but, you know, there are many more female CEOs out there. When I was writing my business school essay, like, I remember I was like, I had Google spreadsheets of, like, women executives, and I was pathing, how did they get there? And, I mean, you know, there were very few women for me to choose from when I was writing those essays. And if I tried to write those essays now, I think, you know, 10 years later, there's many more options of people that I could look to as role models, you know, for that 10 years ago me. And so, you know, I feel optimistic that change is happening. You know, is it happening fast enough? That part, I think, is a real challenge.
I want to ask you about building culture at Stitch Fix, because I wonder, even when you were just a tiny team, or maybe it was just a few people, did you even have the luxury of thinking of culture at that early stage, or were you just trying to grind through?
I thought about culture really early on, and I do wonder if some of it, when I was thinking about starting this company, like I was thinking about it in terms of like, well, I want to create like the retail model of the future, but I also want to create the company of the future. And related to that is like, I'm going to work at this company for 10 years, 20 years, whatever. I'm now 7 years in. Like, in this day and age, if you're going to work somewhere for 7 years, like, it's a place you really love. And so, you know, I had this mindset when I was creating the company of like, what would be the company that I would want to join for 7 years, 10 years, 20 years? You know, I think the culture that we have, I mean, people talk about diversity quite a bit. And I think for us, like, we have a very diverse team. We have a very diverse management team. But I think it's also this idea of diversity of thought that's super important. And one of the epiphanies with Stitch Fix was that to be able to have two people in a room that had very different perspectives on how to solve a problem ended up with better outcomes than two people who thought the same way. For example, when we have data scientists sitting alongside stylists, like they look at the world in a different way. They look at how do we serve clients better in a different way. And I think the two working together is so much greater than the sum of its parts.
I wonder how crucial you think that is. I mean, imagine, right, people in this audience and listening, early stage entrepreneurs, you know, they've got to think about everything from just getting their product out there and marketing and, you know, competitors and all the things that you worry about. I mean, could you argue that at the very early stages, thinking about culture is an indulgence, or do you think it's absolutely critical and crucial that that's baked in from day one?
I mean, I think if you're going to have the best outcome for your company, it has to be crucial. I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think one, I think it is the team that you have, like all of, I mean, Stitch Fix is such a great example because there was a point in time when like I was in the room when we packed out every fix and when we styled every fix. And obviously now I can't do that anymore. And it's all in the hands of a team and a culture. And like eventually, if you're successful, if you have more than 10 people who are, you know, working for you, like you are your company, the fate of your company rests in your team. Mm. And what is going to keep a team motivated, it's not money, actually. It really is the culture. It's like, what are they getting out of their day-to-day? We all are lucky enough to have many choices in terms of where we work and where we spend our time. And they have to be choosing yours every day. And so, you know, I really believe that, like, if you aren't setting that up from day one, you aren't realizing your full potential as a company.
You do something really interesting. You think of your job as a different thing every year. I've read that you describe it as you rehire yourself every year. So what does that actually mean in practice?
Yeah, so, being a CEO is... it was funny, in the very early days, I remember I had a friend from high school who like came to visit our tiny office at the time, and he was like, I feel like your job is kind of like CEO / janitor. And it really was in those early days. Like some of the things were like, I need to make sure the printer has toner. I need to make sure that when somebody's starting that they would have a desk and a computer. And so, you know, I think the recognition that like your job changes and, you know, to be able to have this, you know, I guess process or just like this reflection of like, what is my new job today? What does that mean in terms of how I spend my time? And also like, you know, do I still like this job? I think this is practical for me as CEO, but I think it's also practical for anybody who's employed at a company that's growing, where, you know, I think there are people who say like, I love the early stages running out of toner and, you know, crazy running around, like love that stage and don't love the stages later. And the reality is like the job changes. And if you're not recognizing the ways in which the job are changing or the ways in which you are changing, then you can get stuck and nostalgic. And so for me, what I think is super important for me to feel really energized and excited about what I'm doing is really like recognizing that and saying like, this year, like now we're a publicly traded company. Like now some of the new challenges for me are working with public market investors, are creating a longer term strategy around how people perceive the company from a financial perspective. And really really, like, those are interesting new challenges that I didn't have before. And so I think, you know, for me, being able to be excited about the next chapter and the new challenges that come with that, and leaving some of the old ones behind has just been like a really important practice.
How has your leadership style changed 5 years ago versus today?
You know, I don't know that my style itself has changed. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I've developed in other ways, but I think I'm stealing this quote a little bit of just like, I think this like idea of today's leaders need to be authentic. And that's just like, it's such a great currency of like, how do you build trust? And I think I've been forced to just be that from the beginning because there aren't a lot of other examples of people I can try to be like. And so, you know, I think that's been really consistent and true throughout my tenure as CEO. But, you know, I do feel just like, I don't know, I feel more experienced. I feel a little bit more like I know what I'm doing. Maybe the thing that's evolved the most has actually less to do with the company's trajectory as much as it does for my family, which is that like having a toddler at home and expecting another baby just means like you have to ruthlessly prioritize.
Yes.
And so, you know, there are things that I would get super excited about and spend all night doing or just, you know, crazy things that I used to do
and
that like
yeah.
I can't do anymore. Yeah. And so I think that's probably been the biggest change.
In our remaining minute, if you were in this audience 10 years ago and you were watching a version of Katrina Lake here, what do you wish you knew then that would have been helpful to you that you now know?
Well, firstly, I think it's awesome that you guys are in the audience.
Right.
I don't think I did enough to really be part of the entrepreneurship community and really build that network in the early days. So I think that first and foremost, you guys are already doing better than I was. I mean, I think one of the things that I wish that I could have done better with is just having the ability to pull back and see, I don't know, how do I put this? Like as an entrepreneur, I felt like my life was just this crazy up and down roller coaster where it was like one day it was like, today's the best day ever. And then the next day it was today's the worst day ever. Mm-hmm. And it just was this like crazy emotional roller coaster. And, you know, if I pull back the lens, I'm like, it generally looked kind of up and to the right. And things generally were better the day, you know, the 1 month later than they were the month before. And it was just really hard to get out of that day-to-day craziness back then. And so whatever you can do, my advice to me would be like, whatever I could do to be able to get more of that perspective so that I'm not on this emotional roller coaster all the time, I think would have been helpful.
Katrina Lake, founder of Stitch Fix. Katrina.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I spoke with Katrina Lake in October at the How I Built This Summit in San Francisco. And we've got one more of these summit episodes for you coming up next Thursday. It's my conversation with Lisa Price, founder of Carol's Daughter. And thanks for listening to today's show. It was produced by Rachel Faulkner with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This from NPR.
Life Kit is like your friend with really good advice.
So, can I really be truthful?
Like, yeah.
It's just me and you, right?
Well, sure. Let's say it is.
3 times a week, Life Kit is in your feeds with episodes on health, personal finance, personal growth, and so much more. Listen to Life Kit from NPR.
It's so important to give children gifts that inspire them to learn more about topics they love. And that's why I love KiwiCo. With super fun science, technology, and art projects, KiwiCo is perfect for inspiring creative confidence and a lifelong love of learning. I've used KiwiCo with my kids for many, many years now, and it's been amazing to see how they've built these really sophisticated engineering projects that have been designed specifically for their age ranges. KiwiCo projects are designed by a team of educators, makers, engineers, and rocket scientists who brainstorm hundreds of ideas to create the most exciting, age-appropriate, and educational projects. And the projects are tested and approved by kids. No crate leaves without their thumbs up. Discover hands-on fun with KiwiCo. Get your first month free on any crate line at kiwico.com/built. That's your first month free at kiwico.com/built.
Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try and win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. I'm Misha Brown, and I'm the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Every week, guests join me to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time, like who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize. They never imagined somebody might actually try to snag it. But a 23-year-old did, and suddenly Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.